Tonight on Arena, we review The Lying Life of Adults, the latest novel from the enigmatic Elena Ferrante, and Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas is 30 years old. is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Martin Scorsese's Goodfellas is widely regarded as one of the greatest films ever made, particularly in the gangster movie genre. Goodfellas narrates the rise and fall of mob associate Henry Hill and his friends and family from 1955 through until 1980. This month marks 30 years since its first release, with the stellar cast of Joe Pesci, Robert De Niro, Lorraine Bracco and Ray Liotta as the central character of Henry Hill. Jen Gannon joins me now to take a look back at this classic movie. And I know you've been watching it recently, just in preparation for your conversation with us this evening, Jen. Is it still as fresh as it was? I don't know if you watched it 30 years ago, but is it as fresh as its 30 years it might suggest?
It really doesn't feel like it's 30 years old. It feels as fresh and vital as ever, I think. Even though, you know, it's the most quotable, the most referenced of modern films, I think, outside of the work of Tarantino, I do think it just remains as vital as ever. And I think there's something to be said about the pace of it and why it feels like you can still watch it. You can't take your eyes off it. I always say it's like a collection of greatest hits. Every scene is like a greatest hits. And I think that's what works with it. It's like when film, you know, aficionados, when they talk about the masterpieces of cinema, they're usually kind of heavy, laborious pieces of work, something that, you know, has to be considered, like your 2001s, you know, anything like that. But I think Fellas changed all that, because it kind of said that a masterpiece could, you know, canter along at a very zippy pace. It could be fun, it could be hilarious, and it could feature an essential story from a woman's perspective. I think, you know, Goodfellas has everything of all of that in spades, and that's why it still remains as relevant as ever.
There is a real life story at the heart of all of this. There was a Henry Hill.
There is. It's based on Nicholas Pileggi's book Wise Guys, and he is also known as, you know, he has written so many different mobster kind of novels, but this was the one that was concentrating on Henry Hill and his life for 25 years belonging to organized crime. So there is a true life element to it. And I think that's kind of authenticity, that is what Martin Scorsese wanted to capture. It has a lot of attention to detail that really elevates it, I think, from, you know, the gangster genre in itself. And he had to have everything be authentic, from the suits that Robert De Niro was wearing down to the extras. The extras were all employed from the criminal underworld. God help the person that was employing the extras, because they never got their checks. They didn't know where they were sending them to, because they had no social security numbers. Everything was hush-hush under the table. And, you know, I think, as we know, you know, even his mother, Catherine Scorsese, she makes a cameo in the film as Tommy's mother, and she's part of one of the iconic scenes, the dinner scene, where she unveils the painting of a man on a boat with the two dogs, and it looks like someone we know, after the Billy Bat scene. And I think there is this thought and care put into it, because these were the people that Scorsese knew. These were the people that he grew up observing and looking at in his, when he was growing up in his area, you know, where he could see these gangsters and the way that they were being treated, and how the public, how the people that ran, you know, the local businesses actually adored them and feared them in equal measure. And I think that love and the way he observed that from growing up is injected in it, and that's why it feels so warm, really.
Yeah, in fact, let's go to that scene with Catherine Scorsese, the director's mother, but playing the mother of the Tommy character played by Joe Pesci, because it gives a kind of dichotomy, I think, that's at the heart of this movie. They are good fellas, they're nice fellas at one level, but they've just murdered somebody. Are they on the way to murder somebody, or have they just murdered somebody at this point in the dinner
scene? They've just murdered someone. Billy Batts is still in the back, in the trunk
back
of the car.
So then they come into the house and they sit down for a chat with Tommy, Joe Pesci, and his mother, played by Catherine Scorsese.
How's your friend, Henry, there? Henry, what's the matter? You don't talk too much.
What you talk a little bit? It's been quiet for me.
You don't eat much, you don't talk much.
I'm just listening.
What's the matter, something wrong with you?
You remind me of when we were kids, the comparis used to visit one another, and there was this man, he would never talk, he would just sit there all night, not say a word. So they says to him, what's the matter, compadre? Don't you talk? Don't you say anything? He says, what am I going to say? That my wife two times me? So she says to him, shut up, you're always talking. But in Italian, it sounds much nicer, you know.
Nudo content.
Yeah, that's it.
What's that mean?
Nudo means he's content to be a jerk. And he doesn't care who knows it. He's content.
Did Tommy ever tell you about my painting?
No.
Look at this.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
I like this one. The dog, one dog goes one way and the other dog goes the other way.
One is going east and the other one is going west. So what?
And this guy's saying, what do you want from me? Guy's got a nice head of white hair. Look how beautiful with the dog. It looks the same.
Looks like somebody we know.
What do you mean without the beard? No, it's him.
You see, there you go. You kind of liked him. But then just that moment of absolute terror at the end, that's somebody we know. They're obviously referring to Billy Bat there, who's in the back of the car. Joe Pesci as Tommy, Catherine Scorsese as his mother, Robert De Niro as Jimmy, and Ray Liotta as Henry there in that iconic scene, one of several from Goodfellas, and Jen Gannon looking back at the 30 years of the film with us this evening. There's an Irish connection in the midst of all of that, in that picture, Jen, the painting that the mother's describing.
Yeah, there is. Now, the painting was done by Nicholas Pileggi's mother, Susan Pileggi, and it's a recreation of a photograph taken of a man called John Weaving, and he lived on a houseboat on the Shannon, and it's a picture of him that was used in National Geographic magazine in the 1970s. So there is a bit of Irish there, apart from Robert De Niro playing Jimmy, who was, as he calls himself, an Irish hoodlum. So that is a little bit of Irish there. And there's also this, I think there's a thing about it, like you were saying, that there is this warmth to it that a lot of gangster films lack. You do enjoy your time with these characters. They're not one-dimensional monsters. There's a humanity to them. They're charismatic. They're relatable. And I think you get seduced along with Henry as the film goes on, and you want to be a part of their gang. And I think a lot of Irish people can relate to it, because there is this focus on language and humour especially, and how seductive and appealing humour is, and how humour can appease people and make them relax in each other's company. And they're great. All of them are great raconteurs in it, you know. There's so many storytelling scenes.
The other thing, though, is within the midst of all the humour, just like that dinner scene, it either flips from ha-ha-ha, everything's all nice and gentle, into laughter or into something frightening, or the opposite. You're in the midst of something frightening and suddenly it's dissipated with humour. The funny how scene is probably one of the most celebrated scenes in the movie. Just give us the context for this here. Joe Pesci's character, Tommy, he's not happy at the beginning of this scene. And I think we've just seen him in an appalling act of violence here as well, haven't we?
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about, I mean, Joe Pesci's Tommy is a tour de force. Like, he embodies this whole dichotomy about how laughter can slip into something darker and slips into peril. It can be, you know, humor can be used duplicitously and it's concealing his real intentions. And there is that tension between him and Henry Hill. And he is trying to, you know, Henry Hill is basically trying to ingratiate himself with Tommy. And he's saying, oh, my God, you're so funny. You know, you're making me laugh so much. And he's like, sorry, are you saying I'm a clown? And that's when it kind of turns on his head. Slagging someone off can turn nasty.
Yeah, let's listen to how that is handled by Ray Liotta as Henry, and Joe Pesci is the voice we'll hear most of here as Tommy. And be warned, there's certainly some very strong language in the midst of this.
I'm funny how? I mean, funny like I'm a clown, I amuse you, I make you laugh, I'm here to fucking amuse you. What do you mean funny? Funny how? How am I funny?
I'm not just... You know how you tell a story? What?
No, I don't know. You said it. How do I know? You said I'm funny. How the fuck am I funny? What the fuck is so funny about me? Tell me. Tell me what's funny.
Get the fuck out of here, Tommy.
You motherfucker. I almost had him. I almost had him. You stuttering prick. Frankie, was he shaking? I wonder about you sometimes, Henry. You may fold under questioning.
There you go, the famous funny how scene from Goodfellas. And you know, I've seen the film several times. I've heard that clip a million and one times. You still think, oh no, Ray Liotta, Henry Hill is in big trouble here.
there is that foreboding sense, and I think that's the perfect, it's the perfect tone that Joe Pesci uses, where you don't know, because it's the same with the Billy Bat scene, you know, the go get your shine box scene. You don't know if it's going to actually spill over into violence or will it turn into a joke. And that's when it goes the other side of thing, or the scene when Spider is getting him drinks. You can never tell. He's that kind of character where you can never tell what way he's going to go. And the unpredictability gives it that tension that you're just holding your breath all the time, even if you've seen it a million times.
Yeah, and you mentioned this earlier on about the importance of the Karen Bracco, or the Lorraine Bracco character, rather. Karen is the character's name. Because I think most people would think of Goodfellas, they'd probably say, oh yeah, very violent, we're in a very male world, we're in this world of gangsters and there's all sorts of macho activity going on. But the Karen character and Lorraine Bracco's representation of that Karen character is vital to the kind of gender balance, if you like, within the movie, you're arguing.
Completely. It's so surprising when the Karen narrative comes in. I think it changes the film completely. We know that Henry is an unreliable narrator, and I think the inclusion of Karen's story with her perspective, she challenges Henry's authority. She undermines his narrative constantly. I mean, we do fall in love with Henry and his world along with Karen by the end of that, you know, iconic tracking shot into the Copa. We're there with her. We're willing to believe Henry's lies about being in construction. But as the film moves on, she's the only one that actually is picking away at the glossy exterior of this life, and she becomes the emotional core of the film. You know, she's whisked into this world and expected to fit in with this community of women who she dislikes, who have bad skin, and she says herself, like,
let's listen to her actually. The moment when she's meeting all the mobsters' wives for the first time, and she's not impressed, and this is how she expresses it to us.
They had bad skin and wore too much makeup. I mean, they didn't look very good. They looked beat up. And the stuff they wore was thrown together and cheap. A lot of pantsuits and double knits.
She doesn't wake up in the morning. She spends her life in a nightgown.
The woman is no angel.
And they talked about how rotten their kids were and about beating them with broom handles and leather belts, but that the kids still didn't pay any attention. When Henry picked me up, I was dizzy.
And that's Lorraine Bracco there as Karen in Goodfellas. Jen Gannon speaking to us about the film this evening. Does she survive? You know, she comes into a world that she has no idea what kind of world it is. Does she survive that world? Does she outlive it in some ways, Jen?
I think she is the one at the end of the film that can really be considered as a survivor. Like, she sees the quiet menace in Robert De Niro's Jimmy that maybe Henry doesn't see as much. And she is also, but she's also the one at the end of the film that actually loses the most. And I think Karen is such a fundamentally important part of Goodfellas, even if she's not on the poster. I mean, she opens out the film beyond that machismo, and she gives this insight into how easy it is to succumb to this life of crime, but how as a woman you always end up as nothing more than collateral damage. And I think that's something so important. And, it's great that somebody like Scorsese knew that they needed this authority. They needed that female figure to be a part of the film. Whereas it could have just been a jolly, if you like, you know, a thrill ride with these guys. Yeah. She actually centres the film completely.
How influential a film is Goodfellas?
I mean, it's too influential almost. It's made such an imprint on pop culture. Without Goodfellas, there's no Paul Thomas Anderson, there's no Quentin Tarantino, obviously there's no Sopranos. And like, the only way in which Goodfellas actually feels dated now is if you were coming from it as and having never seen it before, you would feel like you've seen it before because so many people have stolen from it. It's been stripped for parts completely, from Thelma Schoonmaker's precision editing, the jump cuts, the freeze frames, the use of voiceover, those long tracking shots, even the use of music to underscore the scenes. Yeah. It's just a masterclass that everyone has adapted, from Boogie Nights to Pulp Fiction to American Hustle, with varying degrees of success, you know, and it's everywhere. And I think it always will be everywhere. There's no way around it. It's so embedded in pop culture that you can't help but reference it.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the music there at the end, because I want to finish up by playing a track from the Rolling Stones, Gimme Shelter, where the Rolling Stones feature, I think, more than one occasion in the movie, but there's a particular scene that you wanted to highlight, I think.
They do. But I mean, there is the scene where they use Monkey Man actually by the Rolling Stones a couple of times, but they do use Gimme Shelter as well. But there is the scene towards the end of the film, which I think is just a virtuoso mix of editing and direction, where you are on that tour with Henry, where he's speeding along in more ways than one and having the worst day ever. And they use this mix of Nielsen, the Rolling Stones, The Who, George Harrison, Muddy Waters, and it's head spinning. But it's this gives you that sweaty feeling of anxiety, gives you the opportunity to feel as shaken and paranoid Curtis Henry. And I think, you know, most films these days, that their use of music, they don't understand how carefully chosen Scorsese did this. Apparently he knew what music he wanted to do for that scene 3 years before he even made the film.
Well,
and that's how close he is to the soundtrack.
Well, we're not going to do all of the mix. We'll give a little bit of a gimme shelter as a taster. But thanks to Jen Gannon there speaking to us about Goodfellas, 30 years old this month, available to watch online. And it's on Sky Movies actually tonight at 10 p.m. And here are the Rolling Stones with Gimme Shelter. Little taste there of Gimme Shelter from the Rolling Stones, as we remembered. 30 years of Goodfellas coming up to almost 22 minutes past seven. And news just reaching us, in fact, that Maggie O'Farrell has won the 2020 Women's Prize for Fiction for her wonderful novel, Hamnet. Congratulations to her on that win. We spoke to her earlier this year about that novel, in fact, on April the 16th. So we're going to tweet a link to that interview on our own Twitter page at RTE Arena. Teenage girl Giovanna, living in Naples, uncovers a nest of family secrets and lies. And the very mention of Naples probably gives it away that I'm talking about the new book from Elena Ferrante, the author of My Brilliant Friend and the quartet of Neapolitan novels that have made her a household name. Yet she remains a particularly evasive personality. The new novel is called The Lying Life of Adults. And Dr. Enrica Maria Ferrara from the Department of Italian at Trinity College has been reading the book for us. And she's with me in studio now. It's amazing that we don't know who Elena Ferrante is.
Yes. Yeah, it is amazing. Thank you very much, Sean, for inviting me here. It is amazing, but there's been a few speculations about herself and her origins. Now, she let it slip through essays and interviews that she's from Naples, so that she is. She lived in Greece for a while. She's a translator as well. But for me, there is no doubt that she's from Naples, because I'm Neapolitan myself. I might sound it too. But definitely, by the way she describes the city, the way she has a very much a sense that there are two Naples. The Naples of the lower classes, the very rough Naples of Gomorrah, so to say, and the Naples of the upper classes, is big Italian, that are full of professional people, and they don't mix, the two Naples don't mix. And this comes through very, very strongly in her novels.
Yeah, and you say that the upper classes who speak Italian, and I can hear people, don't the others speak Italian as well? They speak a particular Is it a type of Italian, a dialect of Italian?
Yes.
How would you describe it?
The lower classes speak Neapolitan. Now, when characters in Elena Ferrante's novel speak Neapolitan, you will know, because it is a kind of a very rough, obscene, loud Neapolitan. Now, Neapolitan doesn't have to be that. Mm. It can be also very, you know, posh. Well, not posh, but like it has a literary tradition. But Ferrante makes her characters speak in this particular way, or some of these characters speak in this particular way, pointing at the fact that there is a very strong separation between the two towns. Mm. And only a Neapolitan would know that.
Yeah, and that might cause problems when it comes to translation, but we'll talk about that when we get into the specifics of the current book in particular. But I'm saying she. I may not even be right in my use of pronoun.
You might or might not, but at the same time, we know that she identifies as a woman. She wants to be known as a woman. And this is a very important statement, because we know that in all her books, she has it against the patriarchy. You know, she is particularly passionate about the destiny of women and about their liberation. But we know that there's been speculations about the fact that she might, in fact, be a man, or she might be right in conjunction with a man.
And particular this, man in question here, is it Domenico Starnone?
Exactly. Yeah. You're very, you're an expert, you know, even more than me. Domenico Starnone is a Neapolitan award-winning author himself. He won the Strega Prize, very prestigious, in 2000. And he's married to a certain particular woman, Anita Raya, who's a translator. And she has been appointed, the speculation is that the two of them are working right. as a team.
Right. The plot thickens for sure.
Yeah, the plot thickens.
We're not even into the book yet. But just briefly before we go there, can you see if, because you know the writings of Starnone, I think you're familiar with his yes. work, we can say his work in the case of Domenico, and you're familiar with the works of Ferrante. Can you see similarities? Do you see tie-ups that suggest that there might be a link between the two writers?
Well, yes, I personally think that there are startling similarities between the way they treat their characters, in particular the fact that there is a certain raw emotion and ferocity of in certain characters lurking underneath the surface. And this is where the two writers are very well able to express those emotions. And also, Starnone builds the identity of his characters in connection with the place, with the Neapolitan landscape. And that is very present in his novels. Mm. In particular, the novel Via Gemito, that was awarded the Strega Prize, has very similar settings to The Lion Life of Adults. And that is striking.
And Ferrante's work in general, identity is important, but it's particularly important in the case of the novel we want to talk about now, which is The Lying Life of Adults.
Yes, and identity is important. And I'd just like to finish up about the identity part. I think that it doesn't really matter at the end of the day if it is a man or a woman, you know, like the author of this book and who it is. And what I think Elena Ferrante tried to do is to underline the lack of boundaries, of borders between gender, between race. And this is what specifically she wants to do. She points at a type of identity that I would call post-human. And this is important relation to the new novel as well. Now, identity is a centerpiece in this novel.
So we're in the company of a young woman, really, for most of the novel.
Yes, it is 12, 13 years old, Giovanna Trada, who lives in a very good part of Naples, in the Rione Alto, the high suburbs, and that is very much separated, as I said, from the lower class neighbourhood of Pascone, where her father is from. Now, at the beginning of the novel, we have a sense that she has a real identity crisis when she overhears her father saying that he's getting the face of Vittoria. Now, Vittoria is the father's sister, so Giovanna's aunt. And the face in question seems to be a particularly ugly face, at least in this girl's imagination. And the idea that this is an ugly face, which she doesn't know because she's never met the aunt. The aunt has been blanked, has been cut out
family
of
troubles.
Their life. Family traumas, that often happens. Mm. But in this particular case, she has a vivid impression that the aunt has a face that combines together ugliness and meanness.
Yeah, but the whole aspect, and it's right across the book in several different places, several characters are described purely in terms of their physical attributes and often in terms of how beautiful or how ugly they are. That's quite a striking way to constantly describe characters.
Yes.
And it's all about who's looking at the character, I guess. So who is looking? Who's doing the beholding in this book for
Absolutely.
Us?
Absolutely. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Yes, the beholder is the father, Andrea Trada, who he has all the answers. He knows what's right and what's wrong, you know, what's beautiful and what's ugly. And but at the same time, he's not a reliable man.
Mm.
And
he's not truthful. The Lying Life of Adults
exactly.
tells us that.
You know, like, so there is a plot, a thick plot of lies, you know, like that unravels, you know, like from this first trauma that the girl has. Starting from that trauma, she will eventually meet Vittoria. And the one thing that is very important and I think is striking in the book is that the face of Vittoria has been deleted from the family pictures, but not just cut from the family pictures. She's been blackened. She's has been cancelled. And so Ferrante, in this way, she wants to point at the idea of the radical otherness, of the fact that we are essentially, and we're used, you know, like we do it all the time, and even within our families, we have this attitude of separating us versus them. And this is the idea. The idea is that ugliness is not necessarily ugliness, but it could be just otherness.
Yeah, but I think part of what Janet starts, as she uncovers the secrets of her family and she meets her aunt, I must say, the aunt is a bit, yeah, she's spiky, okay, but you kind of get to like her. I got to like her quite
she's
quickly.
She's one of the she's best things in the novel, absolutely.
Yeah, amazing character. But when Gianna starts to uncover the reality of these secrets, I think she comes to a realization that perhaps beauty is not all about physical beauty.
Oh, yes, of course. You know, like it's not about physical beauty. She realizes that, but she realizes also, as we said, you know, like that she's been told a pack of lies.
Yeah.
Yes. And that the beholder, the person that was, in fact, telling her what was right and what was wrong, what was ugly, he's the one who is, she kind of relies on the man, the father. And this is like one of the important themes in Ferrante's work, to tell a woman and to tell her what is ugly and what is beautiful. And what Ferrante is trying to do here is to criticize the patriarchy, to point, you know, like that, the fact that women are relying on the men gaze, you know, like on the value system that has been constructed and built by men.
And part of the problem there, the problematic issue that arises there, is the nature of that male gaze in many of the male characters, some of the younger male characters.
Absolutely.
And their attitudes towards sex and sexual desire, and how it's for them.
Oh,
it's
yes.
Not for anybody else.
Yes, yes. Then this is where, you know, like it is important that Ferrante highlights that, you know, the lies of men, or, you know, like suppose, you know, like the lies of the patriarchal society are creating this separation between mind and body. And this is what really troubles Giovanna. And yes, what you're saying about the attitude of men, you know, like towards women, there are particularly unnerving sexual acts and the description of sexual acts is particularly unnerving, is particularly graphic, and it nearly sounds, you know, like in the majority of the cases, like self-inflicted rape. And I say self-inflicted because it's Giovanna that at one point, you know, like when she's in the middle of this identity crisis, and instead of being objectified by men, she decides to objectify herself, her body.
You've used the word object within all of that, obviously. And objects, I think, across Ferrara's work, or Ferrante's work, rather, there are objects that are vital to the plot. And in the case of The Lying Life of Adults, it's a bracelet. How does Ferrante use this idea of the bracelet to explore other topics?
The bracelet, yes. The bracelet is a very important symbol. In the Neapolitan novels, we had a few objects that had their own agency. For example, there was a pot that exploded, and we had a panel that went on fire by itself, nearly in a magical way. And the bracelet has the same function in a sense, but it is a recurrent object that the character follows throughout the novel. The fact that it incorporates, you know, like it kind of incorporates, you know, like this tangle of truth and lies that the character he's chasing.
Then I touched on the idea of translation, because we had this whole idea around how do we get around the Neapolitan dialect. You say that for anybody from Naples, they immediately would know the character by the particular dialect, the type of Italian they were using. Does that work in this translation? Was that still clear? Is it a good translation in that respect?
The translation is absolutely wonderful. Anne Goldstone has done a fantastic job. I would like to remark that Ferrante doesn't use dialect, but she says that the characters are speaking in dialect. And this is very important, because translating dialect would be very, very,
very difficult.
But Anne Goldstone manages to tap into the emotional aspect of the text. And the emotional aspects of the text are the one when the characters are really thinking or speaking in Neapolitan, in a sense. She has done a fantastic job. I know that I met her in 2015. I interviewed her at the Italian Cultural Institute, and She is a very traditional translator. She works with dictionaries, she works, you know, with pen and paper, but at the same time she's able to capture this outrageous flow of emotion in Ferrante's
But I suppose the fact that Ferrante says the character is speaking, and because it is there sometimes saying the character speaking in a rough dialect.
Yes, and then there are some words, you know, like, but there's not a lot of words, you know, there's just like a few words.
Did you like the novel or not? Are you recommending Elena Ferrante's The Lying Life of Adults?
I would give it a 4 out of 5. Can I say that?
You can. You can certainly say that.
Well, the first time that I read it, I was a bit underwhelmed by it. But I suppose this happened because, like, there was this type of idealization. It was a collective frenzy after the Neapolitan novels. Mm. And after the fourth volume, one even maybe expected there would be a fifth one.
Yeah.
But this book is very, very different. This book, you know, like, nearly comes back to the sound of a noir, you know, like more dark feelings and emotions that we'll find in the first three Ferrante novels. But at the same time, I think even if there are some aspects that are a little bit underdeveloped and a little bit underwritten, I really think that she's a masterful storyteller. And the way she works with language is absolutely worth
it. Did you read it in Italian and English?
Both, yes. Both.
And does it work better in the original Italian, if you're lucky enough to be able to read that language?
I think it works better in Italian, but I'd say that there is a perfect match between the language used by Anne Goldstein and Ferrante's language.
Yeah, and I guess most of our listeners will probably be reading it in English. So
absolutely,
it's good to know
that. So I would recommend reading the translation. Yes, of course.
And what's the name of it in Italian?
The name of the book in Italian is La Vita Bugiarda degli Adulti.
And bugiarda, I presume, is some
bugiarda
kind of...
Bugiarda is lying. Yes,
yeah,
like bugiarda is an adjective for lying.
I think we'll all know La Vita.
Yes,
okay. So The Lying Life of Adults, La Vita Bugiarda de Adulti by Elena Ferrante, translated by Anne Goldstein, is in Europa Editions in 2020. And our reviewer this evening, Dr. Enrica Maria Ferrara, thank you very much. Grazie.
Thank you for having me.
Known for his work with the Choice Music Prize winning duo Ships, and as well as his work as a sound designer, Simon Cullen released a 9-track record of ambient music called Holding Patterns last April. That, of course, was mid-lockdown. And he will finally get to perform this album live as part of the Dublin Fringe Festival this month. And Simon joins me now on the line. Simon, the album came from field recordings that you made while you were visiting Inishturk off the coast of Mayo, obviously. Swinging gates. You got, what obsessed you, or how did you become obsessed with the sound of swinging gates?
Well, Sean, thanks for having me on. It started with, I've lived in a few urban areas around Dublin, and I used to hear the sound of gates swinging behind me as people pass around, and it always just intrigued me. The musicality within that short moment. So I started to try and record bits and pieces of gates, but I found it kind of really I didn't want to be disturbing people by hanging around outside their houses and swinging their gates with a microphone, looking kind of suspicious. So I happened to be out on Inishturk, and it took that opportunity because it's a quiet island with not that many people around, not even a dog barking.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the other hassles you would have had trying to record gates in and around suburban and urban Dublin would have been the fact that you'd have had traffic, you'd have people going past, an aeroplane would arrive the minute you turned on the microphone, no doubt.
Yeah,
it would have been much harder to actually isolate the sound, whereas in Inishturk, I guess that was, in inverted commas, easier.
Much easier, it was a fruitful expedition in that respect, and I got enough material together to go home with and listen through and start to figure out how it might be used in a musical project.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, how much of a variety is there in the sound of gates? I mean, is it a phenomenal variety? Were you surprised that there were little squeaky gates, big deep gates? You know, how broad are the characteristics of gate squeaks?
Well, I mean, like, it's essentially metallic sounds rubbing off each other. There's plenty of examples of similar kind of sounds you can get from instruments and any kind of piece of metal. But I suppose what I was really focusing in on was like the musicality of each different gate and how tones would change as it swings, and what that might inspire me to write from, as opposed to just use that sound in another way. Like,
so is it a case then that you used those sounds, the various different squeaks and versions of squeaks that you got from the various gates that you recorded? Did you use them as a starting point for composition, or is everything we hear, those squeaking sounds, manipulated in some way, be it through synthesizing or whatever you would do in the studio? What do we actually hear on the album?
Yeah, so every sound that's on the album originated from one of those field recordings of the gates, and I used experimented with a variety of different processes to try and see what I could get from it, and found it to be quite there's a lot to be done with it. So I decided to work with those field recordings solely, as opposed to bringing in other instruments and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So see how far I got, you know.
Can you, as we listen to it coming up underneath us there, was there a particular gate that came to the fore for this track that we're listening to, about to listen to part of Somewhere to Be?
Not particularly, but like going back over the project, I have identified probably about 10 specific edits that seem to feature in various different songs, doing kind of different things now, but there's definitely a few magic moments that ended up, like, for some reason featuring in a moment.
Well, let's have a listen to 30 seconds or so of the magic of Somewhere to Be. So a little section there from one of the tracks called Somewhere to Be from Simon Cullen and his new album Holding Patterns, which features the Gates of Inishturk. That's what we're hearing there, various versions of them manipulated, obviously sonically, in different ways. So this is you're going to perform this live, Simon, and I'm wondering, is there a visual element to what you're doing live, or are you just letting that ambient sound, let the sound wash over you and let it bring you wherever it goes?
Well, it's in the Royal Chapel in Dublin Castle, which is quite a nice space in itself to hold a kind of music performance. It has a kind of a certain atmosphere and vibe to it. I'm working with Dee Riley, a lighting engineer, and we're figuring out a synergy to work the lights with several different movements that the music is going to go through. So there is a visual element, hopefully lighting the ceiling that's in there, and a few other bits around, yeah.
Are there other particular either domestic sounds or natural sounds or man-made sounds that you've found in the environment? Are there other sounds that would interest you as potential future projects?
I always keeping an ear out. I find the electric shower to be an inspiration at times, but I'm still slightly reluctant to bring a recording device into the shower.
I can imagine why. Some of those devices are expensive to be bringing into the shower with you.
Absolutely. So, there's all sorts of hums, and I find myself drawn to what's out of place in an environment, as opposed to what's going on in the background. There's currently some big digging works going on up around the Newmarket Square, and every so often this huge machine just goes thumping at the ground, and I've gone up a few times to see what I can get from that. I'm very much interested in what's to be heard and where we live, how that might be more than just background sound.
And well, just one further question on the gates of Inishturk and the various gates that you recorded. And obviously there was the absence of other noise around, which made the recording pretty straightforward. But was there something specific about Inishturk and the atmosphere that the Gates gave you there? Was there something there that, that fed its way into what you eventually made in terms of the music?
Definitely, while I was writing the music, a sense of I guess the loneliness of an island experience. What can be like, not necessarily loneliness, but the isolation of that definitely began to become a theme that was naturally part of the music that was coming out of that. Now, I can't speak to that. That was my plan, or I was going that way. But I think what I truly tried to do was let what I recorded inform me, tell me what to do, as opposed to, you know, manipulating anything in one way first, you know, or the other way. Like, you know, I found a way to be open to what might come, as opposed to push for a particular angle.
And I guess, but as you describe it there, that idea of obviously the island being a quieter and more isolated place, the Lone Gate, it has a whole different aspect to it that perhaps it wouldn't have in a crowded environment, a crowded urban environment.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. And you know, I kind of did the whole project quite methodically. Although it was that I did it on Inishturk was just an opportunity that kind of came up, and it just turned out to be the best place to do it. Like, it was following my intuition on that.
Yeah, happenstance sometimes is a great man to guide you to the right place. That's Simon Cullen speaking to us there. And Holding Patterns, which is the name of the album and indeed the performance that will be taking place at the Chapel Royal in Dublin Castle on September the 17th. You can find out full details about that on fringefest.com. Peter Roderick is an American singer and songwriter and multi-instrumentalist now based in Galway. And at the end of August, he released his new album Blackberry on digital platforms, with a physical release coming in October. Peter's with me in studio this evening, guitar in hand.
That's
nice to have some live music in studio, getting back to some kind of normality. And you're going to start with one of the tracks, in fact, the third track on the album Blackberry, a track called What Happened to Your Heart?
Yes, you're my first audience since the pandemic hit, Sean. So
well, good.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good to be that.
What happened to your heart? Was it just faulty from the start? Sometimes I've wondered if you locked something up in there that gnawed and clawed at the most vital parts of your most vital organ until, bang, that thing just stopped working.
What Happened to Your Heart, a track there from Peter Broderick, playing live in studio for us this evening here on Arena. And that's one of the tracks on Peter's new album, which is called Blackberry. That song, first of all, now I know we get a direct address to a grandpa at the very end of it.
Yes.
Whose heart are you addressing there? Are you addressing several people's hearts?
Well, I'm talking about my grandpa George, who had a massive heart attack when he was 35 years old that kind of rendered him. He did live for many years after that, but he had a metal pacemaker and was kind of a shell of the man that he once was. And that was all I knew him as. And my mother, as a child, used to tell me that there was a huge history of heart problems on that side of the family. And in fact, Grandpa George had been the first one to live past 35 on that side of the family, the males anyway. So when I was a kid, that went in one ear and out the other, you know. But as I approach the age of 35 myself, I start to think about that again. And so that's been popping up more in my head. And that song just kind of came out one day.
Yeah, but there's also that aspect, obviously, and this is here in the album title, Blackberry. Will come to the kind of double meanings that are in there. But obviously, when you hear a song that asks what happened to your heart, you immediately think of matters around love and emotions as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's kind of what I'm prying into in the song. Like, was it just fate Was it going to be that way, or was there something you could have done differently? Is there something in your life, some way you led your life, or because the heart is connected to the love and everything. And so what is it? I'm just asking. I'm wondering, you know.
I wonder what part did the heart and following the heart play in a recent move for you? You're based in Galway now,
yes.
You had lived there before, but you moved to London in 2019 and you were barely there.
Yes.
When you came back, was that a decision of the heart?
The big city really lost all its charm once all this stuff came at the beginning of the year, you know, and our two-bedroom flat in London seemed, looking back to our rural home in Galway from before, we really just were yearning for that. And so we're back in Galway now with a big house by the sea that's cheaper than our tiny flat in London.
In London,
so,
and a little bit more space for creating and thinking, I would have thought as well.
Absolutely.
And when you talk about we there, you're talking about your wife, Bridget Maypower, and is your stepson in Galway with you as well, Sean? Were they involved in the making of this album?
Well, it was the whole album was recorded in mine and Bridget's bedroom when we first moved over to London. So she was involved in the sense that she had to give me some time in the bedroom in a different way. Also they both sing on the last track, Wild Food.
I presume that is why you're referring to the album with inverted commas and probably with a slight tongue in cheek as experimental bedroom folk. Bedroom folk pop.
Yeah.
So it was done in the bedroom. Was this during lockdown, before lockdown? Or?
This was actually last summer when we first moved over there. That's when I recorded. But you know, making records, it kind of takes a while to do all the plans to release it and all that. So my original intention was to release it in the next Blackberry season, as the name of the record is Blackberry.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that title, because it is a double-edged title, a bit like what happened to your heart, having the few meanings that we've touched on there.
Mm.
Blackberry, the Blackberry season, you're referring to the blackberries growing on the bushes, but are you also referring to Blackberry, the piece of technology, the communication piece?
Well, I do love that it has that meaning as well, because, you know, it's one of the themes on the record that I go into, and one of the songs in particular is this, our relationship with technology.
Is this Ode to Blackberry, yeah?
No, this is actually a tune called Let It Go.
Oh, sorry.
And the Ode to Blackberry is actually just an ode to the Blackberry, the plant.
Yeah.
I do grapple with our relationship with technology, and I try to, these days, I try to balance it out with some time spent in nature and have a real love for wild plants and foraging, and that really inspired this album in large part.
Yeah, because you're saying that the Ode to Blackberry, that song was just a straightforward ode
to the plant
itself.
Hey, thanks Blackberry for growing all around and providing not only delicious berries, but I've learned in the last year that you can weave with blackberry vines, you can make tea from blackberry leaves. It's a very versatile plant, and it was even growing in London when I lived there. So
I was going to ask that. Did you get the blackberries in London as well?
I did. I made lots of pie and jam and blackberry leaf tea and all that, yeah.
So the plan now, the album is obviously out there and happening. Can you get around? There's no way you can start to perform the songs. You were saying, where are your first audience since pandemic?
Yeah. All the venues are very tentative right now on planning anything, and I am myself as well. You know, it's not an ideal time to try and plan any travels, but I am interested in trying to do more here regionally in Ireland, whether it's outdoor gigs or just limited capacity indoor gigs. I'm sure there'll be something happening. I might just take to busking on the street if nothing else will work out.
Well, as you proved in the song that you sang for us this evening, it's you, your guitar, a little bit of finger clicking and a bit of whistling.
That's right.
thrown in to boot. Is there further bedroom, experimental bedroom folk pop on the way? Or what can you do now that you're in the bigger space in Galway?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always loved, you know, messing around myself and recording my own little experiments at home. So I'm sure I'll continue to do that until my dying day.
Well, I hope that is a long way off.
As long as my heart holds out.
Let the heart keep working properly for you. That's Peter Broderick. The new album is called Blackberry, and the song that Peter sang for us earlier on there, What Happened to Your Heart? And that is our lot for this, is it a Wednesday evening? It is Wednesday evening already, for this Wednesday evening here on Arena. Tomorrow night, actually, we'll be talking films, two very interesting films that we'll be talking about. One called Savage, which is the story of New Zealand street gangs. And we'll also be talking about the Vaclav Marhul, the new film, which is called The Painted Bird. almost 3 hours long, causing lots of controversy, this one. Stellan Skarsgård and Harvey Keitel among the actors that are involved there. Those are two of the films we'll be talking about tomorrow evening. And we'll be talking to Stellan Skarsgård actually himself on Friday's programme. But that's our lot for Wednesday. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Leah Murphy was the researcher. Sound supervision this evening was by Ruth Kennington. And tonight's programme was produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.